Before we get to today's show, a special request to any of you who are American expats living overseas. We want to hear from you about what it's like to vote by mail from abroad. As the primaries and November 3rd draw near, what questions or worries do you have about getting your vote in the mail and getting it counted back in your home state? Email a voice memo to myworld@theworld.org. Tell us your name, your location, and we might contact you for a story. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. And thank you. Now here's today's show.
A new coronavirus outbreak in the Gaza Strip is worrying health officials, especially for people in refugee camps.
The already fragile health system that experienced years of neglect may not be able to cope with the challenges of COVID-19.
As New Zealand confronts the mass murderer behind the Christchurch mosque shootings, people are also grappling with how to confront the hate behind his crimes.
It's not a cure that can solve this. Ooh, we've set light on it and it's gone. But I think that those ideas thrive in the darkness.
And pandemic or no pandemic, ukulele players are connecting. It's good for mental health.
There aren't too many angry people who play the ukulele.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The last dictator in Europe is not ready to step down. Alexander Lukashenko has ruled over Belarus for 26 years. A rigged election 2.5 weeks ago got him 5 more. But protesters aren't backing down. They want him to go. The World's Daniel Offman has been following this story in Belarus, and he's been paying attention to some of the symbols adopted by anti-government protesters there.
It's been a historic summer in Belarus. For more than 2 weeks now, tens of thousands of Belarusians have been in the streets, calling for Lukashenko to step down. Different symbols and anthems have popped up as the protests have turned into a movement. People have organized human chains, they've signed petitions, and they've even staged bicycle rallies. Music has also played a major role. The song Changes by Viktor Tsoi is a sort of unofficial anthem of the protests. Another one is Tri Chiripahi, or Three Turtles, by a Belarusian rock band called NRM. Both songs are from the 1980s, Soviet-era underground rock songs adopted by a new generation of protesters. Some are looking back even further into Belarusian history for musical inspiration. Just yesterday at a shopping mall in Minsk, dozens of people came together to sing Pagonia, a traditional Belarusian folk song. The scene went viral on social media.
It's kind of almost like a battle song.
That's Katya Glod with the Center for European Policy Analysis.
And it talks about that if anyone decides to do any harm to Belarus, then we'll get on the horse and we'll fight and we'll protect Belarus from any enemy.
All of these songs resonate because they evoke a sense of pride in Belarusian independence, a country detached from its Soviet past. And it's a sharp contrast with the official anthem of Belarus. This one's a carryover from the Soviet days, and it's been embraced by President Lukashenko. Beyond the music, though, the most important symbol of this protest movement has been the historic national flag of Belarus. The streets of Minsk and other cities and towns have been covered in red and white. That's Maria Kolesnikova, one of the leaders of the political opposition. In a video published on YouTube earlier this week, she says, quote, workers are striking, senior citizens are protesting with us, and the most beautiful flag is everywhere. And it's true, says Katya Glod.
We analysts and historians, we have been completely swept away and amazed by how this flag has actually survived over so many years of suppression.
That suppression came from Lukashenko, because the official Belarusian flag is red and green.
During the Soviet Union, red obviously symbolized the color of communism, and green symbolized the forestry, the woods of Belarus.
And of course, it also included a hammer and sickle. In 1995, Lukashenko adopted that flag as the official symbol for the nation, minus the hammer and sickle. Glad says that's why protesters today are waving the red and white flag.
People wanted to use something that would dissociate them with the regime. And knowing Lukashenko's personal hatred towards this flag, I think it just popped up. It's a very natural anti-Lukashenko symbol.
It's a symbol of a brighter future, Glad says. And the fact that authorities don't like it only emboldens demonstrators. Here's Albert Kengerly. He's a protester who spoke with me from Minsk.
The government, they tried to delete all the national memory of Belarus as a country that can live without the current government and strive to forget this national white red, white flag. Is really messed up.
Protesters like Albert say they no longer want to depend on a system that's built around a single man, especially a man like Lukashenko, who in their mind is no longer fit to lead their country. For Albert, the red and white flag is about hope for something better.
As a symbol of Belarus as a country, not as a country under the certain government, the symbol is perfect.
For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Now to some coronavirus news. Bostonians well know about a notorious conference here in February. The coronavirus spread through the room, then the city. Now scientists know the virus went much farther than that, potentially infecting thousands in Massachusetts and others across the globe. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health, and she's been looking into the study.
So back in late February, this biotech company in Boston, Biogen, hosted a conference, an international conference. So some people were coming in from Europe, from Australia. It was about 150 people or so, not a huge event. But at least one person at the event had coronavirus, and several people got sick. Again, this was like before we really understood domestically a lot about the disease. And then at the time, they suspected this was a sort of super spreader event, meaning that lots of people were infected. But researchers didn't quite get a sense of the scale and the scope. Bronwyn McManus is a genomic epidemiologist at the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard, and she looked into this and released the preliminary data this week. Her group estimated that 18,000 to 20,000 people around Boston may have been infected from this one event, and also that it may have spread to other parts of the globe.
This shows just how far beyond that it can go when the conditions are right. Or wrong, depending on how you look at it.
It's amazing. How did scientists figure this out?
So, Carol, this is where it gets really interesting. They did some genomic detective work. What McManus did is basically collect samples of the virus itself from people who tested positive. But these viruses that people had, it's one strain, but when you get it, it develops a sort of marker. Think of it as like a typo in the genome.
Sort of like ABCD is now ABDC?
Yeah, something like that. It helps researchers identify or connect the virus itself. It's not a mutation or anything. It's not harmful. It's more like a footprint. But it helps scientists basically track and try to associate different cases of this virus to understand outbreaks. And you do that also with contextual information like time and place of infection. There's this database, and this information can be shared across the globe. To piece these puzzles together to understand it from this sort of worldview, I want to have you look at this website, Carol, called nextstrain.org.
All right. I just clicked on it.
Yeah. And in that, you can put in the nucleotide of this particular variant that was at this conference that either came to the conference, left the conference. And so with that, then you can see a map. That yellow represents that variant.
Which I think are illustrating where the COVID cases that stemmed from the conference in Boston.
It may be stemmed or maybe it already existed in those places. Huh. But what McManus then did was look at an additional marker that they connected, sort of came out of the conference of people who had gotten infected to find an even greater level of connection and suspicion. And so this whole approach of genomic sequencing, to kind of trace the virus's spread. It's offering new clues into this pandemic all across the globe.
How so?
I want to turn, Carol, to another country that's super interesting because researchers there have managed to sequence a majority of cases, which is unusual, and that is New Zealand. Again, the number of cases there is much smaller, so there's a greater capacity for it. But this information's actually helped them when they don't know the source of an event at first and what's going on with the spread of this virus. Joep de Ligt heads bioinformatics at the Institute of Environmental Science and Research in New Zealand. It's the main agency that works with the government.
Especially for people where there was no clear link how they might have gotten the virus, so someone that typically stays at home and hadn't been in contact with international travelers, how did they get the virus? And then genomics can sometimes provide hints on where that might have been, because you can then go like, well, it might have been the same virus as that we saw at one of those events, so they might have been in contact with one of those people.
So, Carol, with this most recent outbreak that they've been experiencing in New Zealand, this has helped them kind of trace an outbreak back to a particular building. And it's also helped the government understand how many outbreaks there are, if there's one, and it's helping inform whether and when they may lift the lockdown, which is expected to happen this weekend.
Now, of course, I have to ask you, we started this conversation about this small event in Boston, the scientific conference where coronavirus was spread. I have to ask, did it make it all the way to New Zealand?
So I was thinking that same thing, and I asked Joep, the New Zealand researcher, to put on his genomic detective cap and see if he could look into that particular variant of the virus and see if it matched up.
Should not be more than 10 minutes of my time.
He decided to check it out.
Let's see.
So let's fast forward about 30 seconds. He's looking at that time period.
So that particular event, that particular mutation, was observed in New Zealand twice.
Wow. That virus gets around. That's amazing.
Yeah, so it appears that it made it at least one case or two cases all the way from Boston to New Zealand.
The World's Alana Gordon covers public health. Thanks a lot, Alana.
Thanks, Carol.
We have that link for you to the map showing how one virus strain spread around the globe. Check it out on our Twitter feed. We're at The World. When a research team at the University of Edinburgh set out to the Scottish Isle of Egg, they were hoping to find fossils of marine reptiles. Not much luck with that, but at the end of a long day, paleontologist Elsa Poncherulli found something pretty cool.
And I had walked quite far from the rest of the team, and I turned and was running back along the shore, so just bouncing from boulder to boulder. And I actually stepped on this fossil in this boulder, and I took another several steps before I stopped and thought, hang on, what did I just step on?
Poncherulli quickly realized she may have stepped on a dinosaur bone, so she ran back to her team to relay the news.
I was really reluctant to use the D word.
She didn't dare say dinosaur. You know, you don't want to get the team's hopes up.
So they had to tease it out of me a bit before I said it might be a dinosaur, at which point, of course, everyone drops tools and wants to come look.
That was back in 2017. Now, after analyzing the 19-inch long bone, Poncherulli's initial thought has been confirmed. Researchers say the bone is probably part of a hind leg of a young Stegosaurus, a dinosaur which Poncherulli says would have been about the size of an average car. The bone is believed to be 165 million years old, a rare find from the Middle Jurassic period.
We have lots of fossils from before, and we have lots of fossils from after, but not from this time. So that makes it quite a significant thing to find.
Scientists have spent decades trying to find dinosaur fossils on the island of Egg, which is a pretty small island, less than 12 square miles. Still, Poncherulli's discovery was a needle in a haystack.
You can have hundreds of people walk over the same rock and not see the fossil until the light just hits it the right way or just the right person at the right time. Definitely, definitely luck involved.
But a paleontologist stepping on a dinosaur bone? That's beyond lucky. The bone is now at National Museums Scotland in Edinburgh. You can see it for yourself from wherever you are on our Twitter page. We're at The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The pandemic will have significant long-term impacts on our mental health. That's a conclusion in a new report from the consulting firm Deloitte. The study projects an explosive increase in mental illness for years after the pandemic ends. It based its analysis on what happened after another disaster, wildfires in Fort McMurray, Canada, in 2016. The fires forced 88,000 people to evacuate and destroyed more than 2,400 homes. Anita Elash reports.
Brian Bowdridge was on his last day off from work driving giant trucks in Alberta's oil sands when his life was turned upside down.
Yeah. It was just like the movies, watching a Bruce Willis movie. It was basically what it was like. It was like so real.
Wildfires had surrounded Fort McMurray. Everyone was being told to evacuate. But the roads out of town were blocked. Bowdridge and hundreds of others were trapped.
They were calling it a monster on the news, and they weren't kidding. It was just chomping away, coming towards us. Like, you could hear the houses popping, the gas lines popping. You can hear the vehicles popping from the fires. And I was just like, oh my God, I don't know what we're going to do.
After 3 hours, police finally got the road opened. Bowdridge and his girlfriend made a harrowing escape, with flames licking at their truck and black smoke filling the cab.
I did not think I was going to live. I thought we were goners. I really did. And everybody I talked to thought the same thing.
Everyone in Fort McMurray was forced to leave. They were gone for weeks. Brian was lucky. His house suffered only smoke damage, and he counted his blessings. But he sank into a depression and started abusing drugs and alcohol. Now, 4 years later, he's still struggling with these problems.
Oh, yeah, I'm still on medication. I still think about it quite often. I don't know. That was pretty traumatizing. If I'll ever get over it, probably not.
The report from Deloitte shows that Bowdridge's case is far from unique. It found that visits to mental health professionals and prescriptions for antidepressants shot up in the months after the Fort McMurray wildfires. And the latest data available shows those numbers were still up 2 years later. Matt LaBerge is one of the authors of the Deloitte report. He and his team used that data from the wildfires to predict how the pandemic would affect mental health.
We knew that there would be an impact. I think the magnitude, the sheer magnitude of it was pretty surprising.
Deloitte's model predicts a mental health crisis that will last for years after the pandemic ends. LaBerge says the Fort McMurray wildfires and the pandemic have more in common than you'd think. Fort McMurray residents were kept from their homes for weeks, a huge disruption that LaBerge equates to the home isolation millions of people have experienced during lockdowns. And in both cases, there was an economic recession.
We know recessions have a mental health burden. We know that disruptive events and natural disasters have a mental health burden. When they are combined, it kind of compounds the effect and make it even more difficult to bear for people.
The Deloitte study predicts that visits to mental health professionals will nearly triple. And it says women will be especially hard hit, since three times as many women have lost their jobs so far. Fort McMurray resident Nicole Gravel says she can see the parallels between the fires and the pandemic.
The idea of the unknown, I think, is the scariest thing for people. I think the fact that they don't, look at the way people hoarded toilet paper.
She says she developed anxiety and was just unhappy after the fire.
I pretty much lost a lot of control. Like, I didn't know where I would sleep the following day. And every day it was constantly on alert. And so I think that if you're in that heightened sense of alert for like 4 weeks, that has a lasting impact.
Gravel is now seeing a psychiatrist and taking medication, but she expects the impact of the fire will always be with her. Deloitte recommends that governments start preparing for the fallout from the pandemic now by enhancing mental health services and making it easier to connect with resources. It says employers should also look at initiatives like extra benefits and flexible work hours. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
The Gaza Strip is one of the most densely populated areas on Earth, about 2 million people in an area the size of Detroit. Not ideal when there's a highly contagious virus out there. On Monday, the Hamas-controlled territory reported the first cases of the coronavirus that have been spread internally. This prompted Hamas to impose a lockdown throughout Gaza for 48 hours. The police used loudspeakers to say, "For your safety, stay at home." Today, businesses, schools, and mosques are shut. Beaches were basically empty. Dr. Ayadil Saparbakov heads the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Team in the Palestinian territories. Dr. Saparbakov, these new cases, a dozen people or so, were caused by local transmission. How worried are you that these few cases could spread like wildfire in such a densely populated place?
Of course, the situation in Gaza is worrying for us at WHO. The already fragile health system that experienced years of occupation, blockade, neglect may not be able to cope with the challenges of COVID-19. 2 million Gazans live in a very short strip of land, and 70% of them are Palestinian refugees that live in an overcrowded camp with inadequate living conditions and short supply of clean water. This makes it very difficult for people to keep the physical distancing and follow even simple hand washing to protect themselves from COVID.
Since the start of the pandemic, how many people have tested positive for COVID in the Gaza Strip?
The first case of COVID in Gaza Strip has been detected back in March. And so far, we have 125 cases, of which 51 cases is currently active, meaning that they are currently under observation. And unfortunately, two people have died so far, and the second person died just today.
How prepared are health authorities there to deal with a widespread outbreak?
This actually causes a lot of concerns. Gaza, for example, has only 97 ventilators for 2 million people to treat critically ill COVID-19 patients, and two-thirds of them are already occupied by other patients. We only have 4 hours of electricity in Gaza, and fuel that is required to run the generators in the hospitals in short supply.
What about the ability to get more supplies or to get more ventilators that health professionals need? Is that possible?
Well, WHO, in coordination with the UN agencies, the NGO partners, are working with Israeli authorities and also with the health authorities in Gaza around the clock to support the Gaza's health system. This Monday, WHO managed to bring in 10 very much needed ventilators to scale up provision of essential critical care for COVID patients. More supplies are underway. Additionally, the communication campaign to tell people to keep the physical distancing, to wash their hands, to stay at home, avoid mass gathering, is taking place via social media platforms, via radio, and we hope that it will stop the further spread of the outbreak.
Dr. Ayadil Saparbakov is with the WHO Health Emergencies Team in the West Bank and Gaza. Thanks a lot, Dr. Saparbakov.
Thank you for having me.
This is The World. You go to a pub. It's loud, so you lean in to talk. Not ideal during a pandemic, so Scotland banned background music. Restaurant owners don't like it.
I don't understand why a little background music. Nobody's spitting in our restaurant.
Nobody is spitting in our restaurant. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. The shooter behind last year's Christchurch mosque attacks is facing sentencing in New Zealand this week. Survivors are speaking directly to Brenton Tarrant after he was found guilty of killing 51 people at two mosques in 2019. One of the survivors who spoke was Mirwais Vaziri. He was shot in the neck during the attack.
People were calling me because I was from Afghanistan. They were calling me intentionally a terrorist, but you took that name from me. Today you are called terrorist.
That clip is from Radio New Zealand. Tarrant's attacks were rooted in Islamophobia and white supremacy, just like those of Anders Breivik, who killed 77 people in attacks in Norway in 2011. Åsne Sirstad is the author of One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. She joins us now from Oslo. Åsne, what strikes you about the differences in how the trials and sentencing of these two men, one in Norway, one in New Zealand, how they've been covered?
They've been covered very differently. I would say that the case here in Norway was marked by the urge and the need to know everything, to try to understand and grasp how one of us, a fellow Norwegian, could strike against his own people. But the New Zealand case has been much more dimly lit, if I can put it like that, from the very day the New Zealand Prime Minister said that, you know, she would not pronounce his name. And there is not even a trial, because as he pleaded guilty, he doesn't need to go through a trial. It's just those 4 days of witnesses. So that means we know very little about this person. We know very little about his ideology, who he's linked to, and so on. So it's two very different approaches.
I'm curious about Norway. Was the fact that it was open, was it by design or just the way the press went after the story?
It was not just the press. It was even the judges wanted this to be open. The police wanted this to be open. And the police who were preparing the case, they wanted this because they knew from research that this will benefit the victims. So all the victims had their own lawyers. And those lawyers, they got to read all even the police interviews of Breivik, the psychiatric reports about him that they could share with their clients. Even the victims, you know, parents who've lost their children or friends who'd lost their, you know, best friends and so on. Even though they would say, oh, we can't take it now, it's too much. They just know that it's easier to come to terms with that trauma the more you know about it.
Brenton Tarrant in Christchurch says he was inspired by Anders Breivik. Was it the publicity or was it what Breivik did?
Well, he hasn't really said he was inspired by the publicity. He said he was inspired by him, particularly the manifesto that he wrote. So it's mainly not the trial, not the mainstream media. They inspire and cheer on each other on the dark corners of the internet. That's where they meet. And I think one thing that's very important is that those sites where the far right is inspiring each other is monitored. All this last decade, those terrorists, many of them, including in the United States, they have warned online hours before they commit the attacks, some even days. This is a police job. And then the other side of telling their stories, like I did in the book One of Us, where I really had to try to find out what made Anders Breivik, because of course he didn't grow up in a vacuum. He grew up among us. He actually lived on my street, so that was, you know, a special interest, just like to find out about him. So I definitely think that we need a, you know, bigger police monitoring, but on the other hand, more knowledge.
I have to ask, you said he lived on your street. In retrospect, do you remember ever encountering him?
No, I didn't. He lived a block away. I just learned actually through the trial, again, those facts that I never would have known. Like, oh, so those years, 3 years, he lived just a block away from me.
Do you think the fact that Brenton Tarrant isn't a New Zealander, he's from Australia, do you think that's affecting how New Zealand is assessing how to think about him?
Yes, I think it actually does. It makes it easier to just say, you know, he's not one of us. It's not our problem. Our problem is what he committed here, but we don't really care about him. So no one really claims him. He was traveling between those countries. He was traveling a lot throughout his life, too. So the New Zealanders haven't had to question themselves as we've had to do here in Norway, because they didn't make him. He just came from outside. And that's a bit like when there have been attacks from jihadists from, you know, in Paris or Manchester. It's also an ideology or coming from outside. So those society haven't really had to study their own failings.
You wrote in a piece in The Guardian that hateful ideas die in the light. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that sometimes they're based on conspiracy theory and they should be met. They're based on wrong data. It should be questioned. It's based on prejudices and that should be pointed out. And I think what is important that we teach young people, this is part of history. Like Anders Breivik and Tarrant is part of fascism. They're part of a fascist tradition. That is, of course, it's not a cure that can solve this. Ooh, we've set light on it and it's gone. But I think that those ideas thrive in the darkness, and it's just more dangerous. You know, people would call them monsters instead of saying that evil is also a human trait. They're still humans. And how did they become evil? There's no magic cure. So I just think that we need to learn how to deal with it and to counter it.
Åsne Sirstad is a journalist and author based in Oslo. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The fate of Antarctica's ice shelves has huge implications for sea level rise. They help keep massive amounts of ice from flowing into the ocean and melting. A new study published today suggests that more than half of those ice shelves may be vulnerable to pools of melted ice breaking them apart. Here's the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
To understand why today's news matters, let's go back to 2002. It was an unusually warm summer on the Antarctic Peninsula, and most of an ice shelf called Larsen B disintegrated into a slurry of icebergs. It was bigger than Rhode Island and had been there for 11 or 12,000 years. It took 6 weeks to fall apart.
I don't think anybody up until that point realized how quickly an entire ice shelf could disintegrate.
This is Jeremy Bassis, a glaciologist at the University of Michigan. What scientists think caused this catastrophic collapse is something called hydrofracturing.
It got warmer in the region.
The top layer of Larsen B started to melt.
You got this surface water that pooled on the top of the ice shelf. It formed these pools of water.
Those pools seeped into cracks in the ice, tunneled hundreds of meters down, and eventually cracked the ice shelf in two.
And then all of a sudden that process keeps on repeating until you're sort of turning your ice shelf into Swiss cheese. And then all of a sudden it starts to completely disintegrate.
Ice shelves like Larsen B surround about three-quarters of Antarctica's coastline. They act to stabilize the ice on the continent, ice that is flowing from the interior of Antarctica toward the ocean. Here's Allison Banwell, a glaciologist at the University of Colorado Boulder, who studied Larsen B in depth.
So they're super useful at the moment for keeping the inland ice from accelerating too quickly into the ocean as temperatures rise.
When these ice shelves collapse, inland ice speeds up. So a question consuming Antarctic scientists today is where and when that might happen next, and
how fast and how much sea level rise can occur because of the loss of Antarctic ice sheet.
This is where Qingyao Lai and her new study comes in.
My name is Yao. I'm currently a postdoc fellow at Columbia University.
For the first time, Lai and her collaborators mapped out the cracks on Antarctica's ice shelves to figure out which were vulnerable to hydrofracture. She and seven co-authors published their results in the journal Nature Climate Change today.
I'm actually very proud of this first part of the result.
Lai trained a computer algorithm to spot the fractures in satellite images of Antarctica.
So usually it's dark on one side of the fracture and bright on the other side of the fracture. So we can visually see this high contrast.
Then they used physics models to identify which of those fractures were likely to be wedged apart if meltwater pooled on top of them. What they found surprised them. Roughly 60% of Antarctica's ice shelves both help slow the flow of inland ice and are vulnerable to hydrofracture. That means they could someday go the way of Larsen B.
If this 60% of the ice shelf collapse, they will significantly impact the flow of Antarctic ice sheet.
Melting there will make coastal flooding worse around the world and push up storm surges like the ones we're expecting from Hurricane Laura on the Gulf Coast this week. Jeremy Bassis at the University of Michigan wasn't involved with the new study, but he wrote an accompanying commentary in the journal Nature calling its methods ingenious. He says right now, scientists aren't very good at predicting when the next ice shelf will fall.
It's kind of like one of those television criminal procedurals where they had the forensic detectives.
Scientists look at satellite images of places like Larsen B, almost like crime scene photos.
And then trying to figure out what happened after it happens. And so hopefully with this study, we can start getting a little bit in front of it and have an idea of where the next ice shelf is going to disintegrate.
Now, this isn't happening anytime soon. Hydrofracturing requires both fractures and pools of meltwater. There's not widespread surface melt happening across Antarctica yet. But on the opposite end of the globe, in the Arctic, air temperatures have been warming faster. The surface of the Greenland ice sheet turns into lakes in the summer, and that could happen to significant parts of Antarctica by the end of the century.
The widespread and intense melt that we see on the Greenland ice sheet is a template for what to expect in Antarctica in the future.
Alison Banwell from the University of Colorado Boulder again.
So it's hard to pinpoint when exactly this will happen.
A lot depends on how much humans are able to curb greenhouse gas emissions.
Hopefully we can slow down that process as much as we can.
For now, scientists will keep trying to answer the question, how much and how fast will Antarctica melt? For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Many major events have gone online during the pandemic, classes, concerts, conventions. For a growing group of musicians who play a pretty cool and quirky instrument, they're doing the same. Here's Michaela Lafrac.
If you're looking for some joy in the world, go find a ukulele player. They are unfailingly chipper, even during a global pandemic.
The ukulele is a happy instrument.
Case in point, Brian Tolentino, a ukulele teacher and performer from Hawaii.
There aren't too many angry people who play the ukulele.
Tolentino holds his instrument up to his computer for me to see during our Zoom interview. It looks like a little four-string guitar. It's adapted from instruments Portuguese immigrants brought to Hawaii in the late 1800s. He plays me one of the most famous ukulele songs, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Tolentino spent much of last week teaching at UkeFest, an annual ukulele festival based out of a music center in suburban Maryland. Normally, he'd fly for hours to get there. But this year, he taught from his home in Oahu. Like a typical ukulele player, he saw the bright side in this virtual-only festival.
And we can, again, connect with people all over the world, which is fun, you know. A C in my language is a C in Japan, is a C in Switzerland, it's a C.
UkeFest started a dozen years ago in Maryland as a concert and workshop. Two women spearheaded the event, Marcy Markser and Kathy Fink, a couple and Grammy-winning musical duo.
I found my first ukulele in a garbage can.
That's Markser.
And I picked it up and never looked back.
She says, as a gay woman, creating a musical community that feels welcoming to everyone has always been a priority. She's watched as the UkeFest crowd has grown from mostly Marylanders to a more international crowd of people interested in sharing their musical traditions.
The community is not a competitive community. It's really one of encouragement, bringing people in, jamming on any songs anybody wants to play. It's a very happy crowd.
Teko Ishida is a translator from Tokyo. He went to UkeFest in person 3 years ago, but he hasn't been able to make the long trip to the U.S. since. For him, a virtual festival was a good thing.
Ukulele is basically like a small guitar, so we can pretty much play anything like rock, blues, or whatever. But there's always this positive vibe and sweetness to it.
He says the Japanese ukulele scene is focused on Hawaiian music. But when I ask him to play something, he picks the Charleston, an American style of music from the 1920s. American attendees like Lori Perrine of Maryland also rely on the festival for musical inspiration.
You know, it's like being at a buffet, you know, a smorgasbord of music, the Hawaiian tradition, the folk tradition.
Well, pack up all my cares and woes.
The blues tradition, the jazz tradition.
Mm-hmm. even though she loved this year's festival, it wasn't the same. The lag time on Zoom made jamming together more difficult. During lessons, everyone except the instructor was muted. But there was even a silver lining to that. In normal times, lessons are often interrupted by enthusiastic ukulele players messing around on their instruments. They call it noodling.
The big joke is now, you know, no problem noodling because no one will hear you.
I ask her to do a little noodling for me. And I quickly find out one more positive thing about the ukulele. Even though it's such a happy instrument, it still works great if you want to play some classic American blues. For The World, Michaela Lafrak, Washington.
You tune into the show to hear interviews and stories that make you feel connected to the world. Here's one more way you can connect with us 24/7 on Twitter. Join the conversation about stories that keep you thinking and share them. Follow us on Twitter. We're at The World. A train wreck. That's a word many are using to describe what's happening at American colleges and universities this fall. Administrators have two goals. One, stop the spread of a pandemic. Two, continue teaching. It's not easy. There have been some high-profile false starts, Notre Dame and the University of North Carolina, to name a couple of schools that quickly shifted in-person classes to online. Colleges across the pond are getting ready to see how well they do. British universities are aiming to teach students mostly in person next month. At least that's the plan. Eric Liebeck is a sociologist at the University of Manchester. He's in Liverpool. He told us first that universities in Britain are under huge financial pressure to welcome students back in person.
Just simply, if the students don't turn up, the funds of the university run out. So the pressures to have everyone come onto campus are really coming from this need to get the fees via the students' tuition. And if that wasn't the case, then they could probably have a few more options, such as going online only. I think the bigger issue now is a combination of the wider context is a bit like the U.S. The pandemic isn't under control. And then secondly, there's the issue that there's a lot more students planning to come due to the way that the Department of Education's organized things.
Why are more students expected to show up at British universities this fall than were expected?
So this is pretty confusing, and it's because it's very much a different system than the American exam system. But you could picture something along the lines of the SATs, but these would be subject-level tests and a bit more advanced, and those are called A-levels. And you need a certain number of A-levels to qualify for admissions to different universities. The exams are usually taken in the spring and the results are released, and then the universities can finalize the offers. So prior to that, everything is based off of what's called predicted grades. So the teachers would have to write down, we think that this student is going to get an A.
So what happened this year with the A levels? Why is it creating a bumper crop of students who are going to show up at universities?
In March and April, they were canceled at the start of the pandemic. And so the students had these predicted grades, but they've not taken any exams. So they submitted their predicted grades, and then the universities were prepared to receive their grades. But then there's a regulator called Ofqual, and they were tasked with deciding whether a predicted grade was likely to be accurate or not. And this is the controversy, because what they did was they used an algorithm that more or less sent about 40% of the grades substantially down. The algorithm has been proved to be not effective at doing what it's supposed to do. And so what they've done is just scrapped the revised grades entirely and gone back to the predicted grades. So what that does is it actually raises up everyone to a level that is quite unseen in any year, where you have almost every student who could qualify is now eligible to go to essentially the top universities in the country. And so what's happening is the upper tier of the universities, or the schools that lots of students want to go to, those universities now have something like 150, sometimes 200% of a normal intake. But what that means is that there's also universities in the middle and lower tiers that might have very few students at all, because they would normally be coming to them.
So those schools, the schools that expected students who are now not getting them, they lose money. And then the upper tier schools have to somehow find a way to accommodate a lot more students in the middle of a pandemic.
Exactly. So there's enough space in the system, but they're sort of in the wrong places. And there's also not really time for the government to sort this out. So they really made a bungle of this whole thing.
Eric Liebeck is an American, and he's a sociologist at the University of Manchester in England. He's been speaking to us from Liverpool. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks.
The buzz in a restaurant or bar, glasses clinking, laughter from a nearby table, background music, it all helps establish the vibe when you're out for dinner or a drink. But in Scotland, background music has been banned in pubs and restaurants. The idea is to keep people from singing along or yelling to be heard, and thereby increasing the risk of COVID transmission. Now some pub and restaurant owners are pushing back. Marina Krolla is owner of La Locanda in Edinburgh, Scotland, a restaurant that's been in business for 20 years. Marina, it's almost dinner time there at your restaurant. Is it quiet? Maybe a little too quiet?
It is very quiet. It's a wee bit, say, the ambience and the atmosphere is a wee bit cold, shall we say.
So how much does music contribute to the atmosphere of your restaurant?
Oh, it's very important. We're an Italian small family business restaurant, and we've always played some wonderful Italian music in the background. And there's so many customers that have said, we love your music, who's singing, or who's playing. You know, it's very important that.
What kind of music do you play? Like right now, if there was no background music ban, what would we be hearing?
Playing Andrea Bocelli or Dean Martin, Tony Bennett. I don't know if I should mention a few other people. I mean, we've even played Perry Como here, which people love. Bruno Tognoli is another one. You know, there's and people who like music know, you know, they come here often, our regular customers come in and they say, Marina, will you play Dean Martin for me, or will you do this? And of course, you know, we play it in the background. They love it.
So your concern is this background music ban may be right for bars and pubs, but it doesn't really make sense for a restaurant.
Absolutely. I think there's no comparison, you know, to because people are actually eating and they're talking while they're eating. You know, they're having some wine. But it's a different atmosphere, you know, a bar and a nightclub to a restaurant or a hotel, even some, have you know, background music in a hotel. I think it's important to have that. I really do. I think it warms the place up and it's very inviting.
From the beginning of the pandemic, Scotland has been really strict in terms of lockdowns, social restrictions. Do you think the government has gone too far this time?
No, I don't think they've gone too far. I just don't think they're looking at it. I think they're just clutching at, you know, there's no scientific proof that some background music will, you know, get someone to speak louder and cause spit or spray the person in front of you. And I don't understand why a little background music, nobody's spitting in our restaurant, you know.
Marina Krolla is owner of La Locanda. It's a restaurant in Edinburgh, Scotland. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Bye.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.